Hi, I'm Gary Knoll. Nice to have you with us today. When you were growing up, do you remember Ted Mack's Amateur Hour? They promoted Geritol, I do, and so my mom took Geritol. That means she was getting some iron. But the diets that people were eating, the average American, were not healthy diets. Now, we didn't have a lot of fast food back then. You would go to a fast food place on the weekends. But during the day, every day, generally around somewhere between 5 and 6 o'clock, people were expected to be at home with their family and have a meal. Whatever had to be discussed, happy things, sad things, that's where you had that conversation. We didn't have cell phones. We didn't have computers. We didn't have all the gadgets. We did have still a sense of doing homework and scholarship and reading. And every older adult that I knew, their hobby was reading. Now, yes, they had other hobbies, but they were very well read. I lived on a small block in a small city of Parkersburg, West Virginia, on the High River, that had a kind of interesting history. And the older people never retired. They didn't have to. My school teacher, Mrs. Kidd, in seventh grade, was also my father's school teacher as well. She taught until she died. That was not uncommon. And you could always go to them. I'd go over to, you know, one of the teacher's homes if I have a question. She lived a block away, Mrs. Hendricks. And I'd ask her a question. She'd say, well, sit on the swing. And she'd sit on the swing. We'd talk about something. Because I was always I was the kid that was rather shy, believe it or not. Yes, I was very shy. And I was, my mind was always somewhere else because I had so many ideas going around in my mind. And I was always figuring out how to solve problems. And I started to invent. And I would write out my inventions and I'd build them in the basement and to the degree I could and understood how to. My great uncle helped me out a lot. He was very patient. He was an engineer, so he gave me a lot of insights. And some of these inventions were the highway flashing safety sign. I took that to the state road commissioner in West Virginia and he thought it was a very good idea. The electric fabric measure, which I took to Measure Graph Corporation and had to go on a Greyhound bus. There was no seat, so I sat there with my little box the whole trip down to Charleston. And I met with Dr. Carson and his whole scientific team at Pittsburgh Steel, where I figured out how to get rid of all of the all the soot that was coming out, the particulate matter, because I came out one day and here's all the snow, just freshly snowed, and it was red all over. That was the pollution, and it was everywhere. And that's when I lived in Weirton, West Virginia. And so my mind was always creating. And otherwise I was, you know, athletic and a normal kid, average kid, nothing special. But I was always interested in how people thought and lived in my hometown. And I saw that the older people always read. They always had, remember there were book clubs back then, right? Well, there are book clubs today too, but it was expected. It was expected that whatever you did with a sense of purpose. Meritocracy, how well you're doing, counted. And if you weren't doing as well as you should, there were always people who would stay after class, remember that? Or summer school where you could learn to catch up. They didn't ridicule or criticize people. There was no shaming. It was just someone needs some help. You help them. It was that simple. In any case, in the process, I had a chance to observe. Now, why I observed this and my other friends didn't, I can't tell you that. But I observed what people ate, and I observed how much they ate, way too much. But the older people ate very little, and they were trim. And I remember women who would walk around, older women, in sneakers, tennis shoes. And why? Because the regular shoes weren't comfortable on their feet and they were more into eating more vegetables. They had little gardens. And that's all on my block. You know, all of us lived in 1,000 square foot houses, small houses, 1,200 square feet was considered big. But we were happy. Now, this is important. On these little sidelines, there were places in my hometown where the wealthier people lived. We all went to same school, went to same churches and synagogues. We were all friends. We did not have such rigid class structure. We didn't have one school that you went to if you were poor and one if you were not poor. No, everybody was considered as acceptable. Unless you did something, it made you unacceptable. But most people didn't, because it would reflect also on your family. And people would remind you, your family first, and then your school teachers and the principal and the coaches, stop acting out. You're acting like a fool. And that was sitting private, quiet, and you learned a lesson. If you didn't, when you got home, you learned a painful lesson. And so we survived. Yeah, we would drink out of the same water hose. When we were out playing, we would all grab that water hose and we played in the dirt and billboards. Normal kids, right? And not normal today, unfortunately. But we were out exercising. As kids, we were very healthy. And we were getting vitamin D. And we were we would drink orange juice, but never from fresh oranges. I can never remember anything being fresh. You know, everything was pickled and with lots of salt, or if you had some pears or peaches in the middle of wintertime, or plums, they were all in this, you know, can jar with lots of sugar. And yet that's what people learn, adapted taste. And when some people ate, they ate too much. So you started to see the people who were no longer exercising in high school or college, they would start to get the pot bellies. If people tried to keep themselves trim, it just wasn't that successful. But people didn't live long, and hence we didn't see dementia, because they didn't live long enough to develop dementia. Instead, they died of heart attacks, strokes, cancer, diabetes. Those were the big killers then, and they're the big killers today. And in the last 3 years, we've lost over 3 years off our lifespan, and some people more, as much as 5 years off their lifespan. Why? Well, it's understandable. They were at home, afraid to go out. They ordered in, and when they ordered in, they generally didn't order a lot of healthy food. They ordered a lot of food already prepared. Almost always, that's disease-producing food. And those same people are not likely to take supplements or to exercise, and not likely to deal with stress appropriately. So the average American did not spend the last 3 years doing mindful meditation and yoga or exercising. Small percentage did, and good for them. Most did not, and that's unfortunate, because now we have this massive, massive amount of obesity and diabetes and high blood pressure as never before. So one of the things we can do is start to take the parts of our life that are out of balance and bring them back into balance. And as my mother would tell me, don't be concerned about the houses other people live in. Appreciate the house you live in. When we sit down to a meal in this house, we're just working class people. When the other people sit down in bigger houses to have their meal, it's still the same. Families enjoying each other and whatever they have. Appreciate, Gary Michael, what you have. Don't envy what you don't. And I've lived with that principle my whole life, and it really makes a difference. Staying humble in your life allows you to appreciate everyone else's life without being envious of it. So I've never had to have something other people had in order to feel good about myself. I'm not chasing happiness. I'm not chasing success. I'm not chasing adulation. Those are all false idols. In fact, in my world, I don't acknowledge success. Because success, as we know it today, it destroys you. Every single person I know, every single one without exception that became very successful, also, it cost them a lot. Now, the public might not see it, but I've counseled tens of thousands of people and at least 3,000 very famous people, including three of my best friends, closest friends, were billionaires. And so I had a chance to see how they lived, the choices they made, and what impact it had on them. All three, it destroyed their life. Their success destroyed them. And two of them died young, and one's still alive, but hopefully has learned a lot of lessons. They've stopped chasing the golden rings of life. You know, look at what you have in this moment. And the same thing is true about health. When you wake up in the morning, you honor your heart, your brain, your eyes, your muscular system. As I said the other day, just yesterday, by taking L-glutamine, 2,000 milligrams, it helps you maintain your muscle mass. By taking L-carnitine, it helps you maintain your muscle mass. And by using, before you go out for your walk or run or jog in the morning or tennis, take creatine monohydrate and take D-ribose. It can help your energy, your endurance, but also you don't wither away as you get older. And when I grew up, as people got older, they lost their muscle mass. They lost their tone. They got very jowly. They got fatigued. They thought that was normal. Therefore, we had this misconception, the older you get, the less you should do. Don't stress yourself. You know, take it easy. No, just the opposite. The older you get, the more vigorous you should be in your exercise, the more conscious that what goes into your body, because that's going to allow you to live a longer life and healthier in that longevity. So, a simple study from the University of Calgary, people who use vitamin D supplements have lower dementia risk. Now, this was reported in the Alzheimer's and Dementia Diagnosis Assessment Disease and a major peer-reviewed study. So something like one single supplement, or if you live in Florida, where I'm at now, or California, Nevada, you know, Texas, where you get a lot of sun, get out in it, all right? Don't bake yourself in it, but get out for about 45 minutes where at least half your body is getting sun. You can create about 20,000 units of vitamin D from that kind of exposure. So that's good. Helps your immune system as well. So that is what we're learning today. I'm giving you that little background because, look, we are all products of our history. And so many of my friends today are carrying on the same traditions, eating the same foods, the same amounts of not exercising as their parents and my parents. Their parents are not around today, and my parents haven't been around in 20 years. So we should learn some lessons of what we need. And for dementia, you need to exercise. You need a clean, healthy diet. You need juicing. You need a whole full spectrum of supplements, you know, NAD, PQQ, vitamin C, quercetin, Cognitex. You need these things that rejuvenate the brain, repair the brain, cleanse the amyloid toxic plaque out of the brain. You can chelate a lot of this out. Therefore, you can improve your conscious awareness now, your cognition, and you can delay cognitive impairment, and that's important. All right, something simple, but vitamin D starts the process. Now, from the University of Rochester Medical Center, a study reveals how sleep removes toxic waste from the brain. Let me give you one good example of how this works. A very close friend of mine named Neil, who was a lawyer, and we were very close. We'd run every morning around Central Park. We'd race together. He's a great athlete, faster than me. Always had to run to catch up with him. He was an inspiration. But he, when he grew up, he smoked and he drank. And when I met him, he stopped smoking and started to live a healthier life. In fact, he was very conscious. And I had a chance to visit a Dr. Popoff at an anti-aging center, my first that I'd ever visited, and was not going there to get treatment. Instead, I was going there to see what I could do personally to share with other people. So there was a Dr. Goldwag and Dr. Popoff, and they had all these therapies that you could use. And one of them was an inhalation therapy. It went into a little box. It looked like a single person spa, you know, and you go in and you close the door, and there was a machine that would throw this wave after wave after wave of aromatherapy into the air. A wintergreen was one of the smells, and you could taste it. And inside there was a box of tissues, and people would be coughing. And there were about four of these, and I was in one, and Neil was in the other. I didn't cough, you know, I just breathed it in. It was inhalation therapy, right? And it was supposed to remove toxins from your lung. I'd never smoked. And I didn't have any toxins. I just enjoyed it for a half hour. But I could hear everyone else coughing. And when he opened the doors and he said, "Now, take a look at your tissues. My buddies were all black. All black. Every one of them. And it freaked Neil out. He said, what's going on? He said, when you stopped smoking, you thought that everything was okay. But this is what stayed in you. And this ultimately is what could lead to lung cancer. So that was a real awakening. Wow, I thought if we were healthy, we would be stay healthy and go healthier from there. No, you have to undo the toxins, undo the damage. And that's a journey that very few people ever take. That's the detoxification part of life, where you go on a detox, you really detox. But we make the mistake in our culture of thinking, okay, I stopped drinking, my liver's fine. I stopped smoking, my lungs are fine. I stopped overeating, my pancreas is fine. I'm going forward. It doesn't work that way. Because whatever damage you did, in most people, will stay damaged. It becomes your weak link. And sooner or later, that weak link can tip into disease. And therefore, detoxifying is so important. But most people don't want to go through the detoxification stage. They just want to go through the rejuvenation stage. And it's the difference. In any case, and modified fasting helps with that detoxification. Juicing helps with it. Green juices in particular. Chlorophyll, chlorella, is good. And wheatgrass powder is good. Taking that each day. Having lots of sprouts in your diet, that's good. Bitters are good. But lots of juicing really cleanses out and rebuilds. So, in any case, I just want to share that with you because over the next several years, I asked my buddy, when are you going to start detoxing? Well, I feel okay now. I said, that was just one treatment. And he said, you're going to have to do a lot of this. He didn't. He would later develop cancer and die. And that was really sad. He didn't even tell me he had cancer. And his son said the reason he never told you he had cancer is too embarrassed. He was so embarrassed because the son said, Eric said, Dad said that he felt ashamed that he had taken the easy road in all the easy choices instead of the harder road and to have done it right. One of the things we all experience in life, all of us experience making wrong choices at different times, but making up for that wrong choice, trying to repair the damage from that wrong choice, that's an important place in life as well. So making sure that you don't stay up all night, as a lot of people do, they don't care what time they go to bed. Your body does. Why is this important? Here's the lesson. Anytime we've overcompensated and done something that throws us out of balance, we have to recompensate to put us back into balance. That takes time, focus, energy, and discipline and purpose. And how many times when we're working, we're socializing, we don't think about sleep. We're thinking about being in the moment. We're having fun. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. So what? But there's where one of those foundations takes a beating. And you're not going to get all the waste out of your brain. That's according to the University of Rochester, unless you get a good night's sleep, 8 hours of sleep. I also recommend over the age of 40, take a half hour nap each day as well. Even if you're not fully asleep, but at least rest. And do it as a meditation, that can help. So once again, your body has to be detoxified. Your brain has to be detoxified. So how do you do that? A good night's sleep. Now, we don't know all the mechanisms yet. There's no question that sleep is crucial for your brain and overall health. We know that melatonin is secreted by the pineal gland in deep sleep really helps detoxify. But what happens when you wake up throughout the night? What happens when you turn on the light? What happens when you have electrical impulses coming in from your computer that was not unplugged, but just turned off, still pulsing? That can also disrupt this process. So instead of getting a really good detoxification at night, where your cells, all over your body, not just your brain, are taking the toxins out and your body's repairing the damage, at least to the degree that it can. And a lot of your damage can be repaired if you focus upon it. That's why in all the counseling I do, I always offer a detoxification program to begin the process. Because no matter what I'm faced with, if a person has cancer or heart disease, I never focus on that. I focus upon what do we have to do to get your body back into balance? Detoxify it. get the toxins out, heavy metals that are logged in a person's body, cadmium, mercury. All right? And you do that with sulfur, sulfur in the form of garlic and onions and shallots. Yes, and N-acetylcysteine and L-lysine, etc. But it means you have to study it, and there has to be a reason why you're doing it and motivating you enough to do it properly. But without proper sleep, the chances of disease and stress increase substantially. And now researchers at the University of Rochester Medical Center, published in the Translational Neuromedicine, have found that sleeping actually helps detoxify the brain, potentially offering clues into dementia and Alzheimer's. And the study was published in Science, reveals that your brain has a unique method of removing waste through the glyphatic system and also your lymphatic system, allowing for waste to get out of the body. Sleep changes the cellular structure of the brain. That's important. Good night's sleep, you wake up, you feel better. Your body functions better. And the research looked at something called a glymphatic system of the brain. So they found that when you're sleeping well, your brain is able to get rid of the debris, which is important, and healing occurs. Remember, you have all these agents in your body that help you, including helping with beta amyloid plaque, a protein associated with Alzheimer's disease, and to detoxify that protein during sleep. So good night's sleep helps your brain. And early life stress can disrupt maturation of the brain's reward circuits, promoting disorders, so says the University of California. What they say is simple. A new brain connection discovered by University of California, Irvine, researchers can explain how early life stress, an adverse trigger, disrupted operation of the brain, and especially its reward circuit, offering a new therapeutic target for treating people that would be diagnosed with either depression, anxiety, obsessive compulsive, other conditions. So we should be conscious of also how regressive hypnosis can also help, and it's one of the best ways of helping you to overcome early life negative impact so that you're not dealing with the epigenetic consequences. And from the University of Cambridge, which is Cambridge University, of course, the United Kingdom, just 11 minutes of a brisk or fast walk is enough to reduce the risk of early death. Yes. 1 in 10 early deaths could be prevented if everyone managed at least half the recommended level of physical activity. This is a team of researchers. They published this in the British Journal of Sports Medicine. So for goodness sake, get out there and start walking. And I don't recommend 11 minutes. I recommend 45 minutes and at least 15 minutes that do it quickly. And that can help you prevent early death. You can take a break now, and we're going to come right back with a whole lot of interesting information. Or if you just listen or watch the health nutrition segments every day, we're giving you more. But in any case, we're going to be back in a moment. Go to GaryNall.com or PRN.live for more quality information.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Opportunities now for you to call in and share comments on several topics. In fact, any of the issues that we've been covering, please feel free to tell us what you think. For example, there's new information that the people behind artificial intelligence and all these different thousands of companies are racing each other to see who's going to be the first $1 trillion company, who's going to win the Nobel Prize. And now they want to take artificial intelligence to a new level where the artificial intelligence actually has a conscious. That means they're fully capable of making any decision that they want without any human programming. In fact, no human will be able to control their programming. Now, that's going on right now as we speak. And yet there is no sense of concern. Like, hey, this is a good thing. You mean we're going to have robots that can serve us, work in our house, be our lovers. Yes, all that's going to happen. And imagine the kind of person that would want and demand someone to do things for them and who can afford it. These are not going to be inexpensive. Your working class will not be able to afford any of this. But the wealthy people, and let's get over this idea there's 1%. There's not. There's never been 1%. What you have is you have a fraction of 1%, like 1/100th of 1%, maybe 20 people who have the power to control whole industries, even the industries we think are competitive. They might own 15 pharmaceutical companies controlling interest in their stock, which means they control the companies, but always behind the scenes. They may own 25 of the largest food companies in the world. So it doesn't matter which food you're eating, they're controlling it. So they never lose. If the market goes up, they profit. If it comes down, they profit also. If you have debt, they profit off your debt. And if you don't, then they find ways to profit off the currencies. But what we're dealing with is we're dealing with one of the most powerful groups that never uses its power, the professional class. And when you consider the people in the professional class are also defending and protecting their family members, you're talking about around 18 million people. Now you can throw into that the about more or less 12 million millionaires and their families. So now you're dealing with what? You're dealing with somewhere between 28 and 30 million people who are very wealthy. Let's just say for argument's sake that it's 28 million, okay? But you got four people per family average, or let's even be conservative, three people per family. Then we're dealing with the impact of being in that bubble, that economic bubble, the professional class bubble, the social bubble, about 84 million people. Now, 84 million people, that if you took that as a part of the whole, you're dealing with about 336 million Americans. So that's 1/4 of the entire American population. So it's not a small 1%. It's closer to 20% of the people. Now, what do you see in these 20 people? A, single-minded, highly educated, very motivated, and always called in as the experts because they've worked to attain a certain level of expertise. And in their field, they generally know each other. If you challenge the people in your group, you're excluded. If you go along with what's in your group, you're rewarded. Now, apply that to the scientist. Look at the scientists who are all, to every single one, outstanding careers, ultra-Orthodox, people who sat at the inner sanctum. These were the people whose advice was always sought. They questioned some part of COVID. They were all excluded, attacked, and their reputations tried to be destroyed, in some cases exceeding. Now these people are fighting back, and they're fighting back because they're smart. Look at Dr. Pierre Corey. He's now going complimentary. And yet, in a film that I filmed him, he said, in my entire career, I never thought anything within the complementary alternative way of looking at disease or health had any merit. Now, it's actually what I support because it has the most merit. The same is true with Dr. McCullough and not so much Dr. Malone. And there's a whole lot of fighting between Malone and others in the field. I cannot say at this moment, and will not, who is correct. But there are people working together. As many as 17,000 physicians are now working together to challenge this. Now there are journalists who refuse to challenge the orthodoxy, and therefore they're rewarded. All the journalists who challenge the orthodoxy are punished. So we have a very divisive world we live in. And unfortunately, it is getting even more tribal and more splintered, more balkanized. So you can imagine the confusion of the average person. What do I do? What do I believe? Where's the truth? It's understandable. People are confused unless you're given the truth by unbiased sources. So what is on your mind that is concerning you? What do you see the problems of being and what do you see the solutions being? Our talkback number is 888-874-4888. Now, I want to thank Steve Brown, a close friend, but also he has been one of the leading voices in America for a liberal perspective on life. Yeah, he has funded many liberal causes, major supporter of The Nation magazine, but he also supported Covert Action Quarterly, and I've had a lot of respect for Covert Action Quarterly. I wish they would cover more current topics, but they covered the older topics with extreme attention. And recently, just right now, as we speak, they've just come out with a new article. And Steve sent it to me. And it tells you the most definitive story about the conspiracy of who's really behind all of this. Who's behind it? All right? Who's behind the COVID? And we hear from people we would not have known even existed. And yet, it's very detailed. And also, my documentary, Science for Hire, was mentioned and quoted substantially in this. I want to thank them for that. But this is an article worth reading. Now, if you haven't read it, I'm going to read it on the air, probably in the next two programs. It's extremely detailed. But names and organizations, including the CIA, are coming up, not just Echo Health Alliance and Peter Daszak and some of those people. You're going to hear from a lot of people you didn't know existed and how they play this all. So the real string pullers are exposed. I want to thank and commend Covert Action Quarterly and its very courageous senior editor for having done this. That said, I have a couple clips to share with you now that I think are important, and we're going to go to those. Our first one coming up is, this is really hard-hitting, and this is what happens when the government employees that we pay and are paid very well and all their health care, etc., and it's almost impossible to fire them. What happens when they're working on something that we are funding, we, the American public, they then turn that over to a pharmaceutical company, and the pharmaceutical company gives them a big royalty on, and they get to keep it. And we're not talking about a little bit of money. We're talking about over $100 million to a group, and this never is made public. Well, doesn't that bias? If you were a journalist and you went to a scientist at the CDC and you said, can you say with certainty that the current vaccine is safe and effective? Absolutely, it's safe and effective. I worked on it. Do they also then say, do you get any money? Of course I get money. I get tens of thousands of dollars on a regular basis. But you were already paid by the American public. Isn't that double dipping? I'll call it what you want. It's completely legal, just like every member of Congress can do insider trading. They can get information sitting on a committee where there's going to be a merger between two companies. They say, merger, two companies, stock's going to go up. And so I'm going to buy that stock. That's illegal. We go to prison for doing that. They get away with it. This is the insanity of such a completely, irredeemably corrupt government at all levels. City, state, in New York City, it's a cesspool of corruption. They want to put in five toilets and charge $5 million. $1 million a toilet. I'm not kidding you. $1 million a toilet. But they could get away with charging $100 million because everyone is corrupt in New York. Everything. The unions, everybody's in on it. And the average person is in on it. How you're in on it? Because you don't care about it. Well, that's not my money. Yes, it is. Why do you think they're charging extra on all these taxes? Utterly corrupt. So when it comes to government, I am opposed to all governments as they exist now. I'm not opposed to having proper rule of law and order and systems that work to benefit of all citizens. I am absolutely opposed to the partisanship and, well, we got ours. It's up to you to get yours. So this is Cheryl Atkinson. I'm going to commend her, an outstanding reporter, and she's been vilified. She's been demonized up on Wikipedia, but she's doing a short interview here. We're not going to take much of it. about scientists earning private royalties on taxpayers' time. I think it's wrong, and yet it's absolutely right for the scientists. And how are you ever going to get an honest answer out of a scientist that's already been bought? Here we go.
All kinds of things go on in government every day that, if they happened in private industry, well, it would be a big scandal. It might even be illegal. The federal government and the bureaucracy have become so large, so powerful, and so persistent that there are endless rules and laws they've made and passed that enrich and benefit themselves. And it seems there's little that ordinary people can do about it. This week on Full Measure, Sunday, February 26th, I'm going to take a look at the example of government scientists earning royalties from inventions they discover while working for us and getting paid for the discoveries when they're sold to private companies like the pharmaceutical industry, where they are then considered proprietary rather than public. And then the pharmaceutical industry shares the royalties back with the scientists. It's as if we, the taxpayers, are subsidizing an invention arm for private industry that works for the financial benefit of the companies and the scientists, but not the taxpayers who are footing the bills. A nonprofit watchdog group, which has dug deeply into this, is called Open the Books, and it's produced some startling results. In this podcast, we hear an extended interview with founder and CEO of Open the Books, Adam Andrzejewski. Can you frame this investigation that you did that had to do with potential ethical conflicts of interest within the National Institutes of Health? And I think a lot of people started paying attention to this when Dr. Anthony Fauci, head of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, was questioned about the money he might be making on the side, some would say, through things that he deals with in his public role. And he literally told Congress, more or less, it's none of your business. I don't have to tell you these things. Which is pretty surprising because it would seem to be important.
So during the pandemic, I think the American people started to ask the question, just how close is big government to big pharma? And Cheryl, now we know the answer to that question because of our work at OpenTheBooks.com. Every single year, the NIH doles out about $32 billion worth of federal grant making to 56,000 recipients. And that buys you a lot of friends within the entire healthcare complex across the country. Now we know coming back through the other door over the course of the last 12 years was hundreds of millions of dollars of third-party royalty payments paid in secret to government scientists. 2,407 scientists received over that 12-year period, according to the NIH disclosures to our organization, $325 million. Now, all of that payment stream on third-party payments has been hidden. We filed a Freedom of Information Act request for that database 17 months ago. It hadn't received scrutiny since 2005 when the Associated Press got the entire database. NIH ignored our Freedom of Information Act request, so with Judicial Watch as our lawyers, we sued NIH for the database. Starting in February of 2022, they admitted to holding 3,000 pages covering the period 2010 through 2021 of line-by-line royalty payments to scientists. It took them 10 months to produce those 3,000 pages, and when we distilled and quantified the numbers, it was $325 million. But still, they're acting like they have a lot to hide. But for employing forensic data scientists at OpenTheBooks.com, the entire disclosure would have been worthless, because here's what they redacted. They redacted the name of the third-party payer. Think pharmaceutical company. We don't know who paid it. We don't know how much each individual scientist received. We can only see their names and count the number of times that each scientist received a payment. And they also redacted the invention, the license number, or the patent number. So we don't know. We don't know who received how much based on what invention, and we don't know who paid.
Can you break this down in really simple terms? Because I think this is a little hard to follow. People may not understand that government scientists and government employment are taking part in inventions partnerships with private companies and then receiving payments from the private companies in terms of royalties or some other payments. Did I describe that correctly, or can you make it clearer?
Yes, you described it correctly. So here's how the third-party royalty complex works. You have a government scientist funded by taxpayers, and they work in a government lab that's also funded by taxpayers. And when they have an invention, they have a special situation. The NIH, National Institutes of Health, then licenses that invention.
An invention meaning a drug or a device?
Yes.
Okay.
To the private sector. And the private sector then pays royalties back to NIH. NIH then distributes those royalties on a royalty split schedule back to the scientist. So over the course of the last 12 years, the total amount of payments from the industry on licenses to NIH in total has amounted to $1.35 billion. The split to the scientists, as disclosed by NIH, has been $325 million. So this is a secret stream of third-party royalty payments that has enriched the agency, its leaders like Fauci, former head of the NIH, Francis Collins, certain heads of institutes at NIH, and 2,407 of its scientists.
How does this stand, do you think, to impact the work the government does on behalf of public health? What conflicts arise?
So every single one of those individual third-party royalty payments has the appearance of a conflict of interest. And that's been the position of OpenTheBooks.com, but it is also...
Also, I'll put this to even better illustrate. We have now what is called the public-private cooperative ventures, but it's a lie. And why? Because the outside forces, the BlackRocks, the Vanguards, the Berkshire Hathaways, the big, big money managers that buy up companies' assets, they have control. So then they also have control over the pharmaceutical industry, which also then has control over the FDA, the CDC. And these are the people that say, you're the commissioner of the FDA. You're coming from the pharmaceutical industry. Protect your interests, and you'll get a big fat check when you come back. And that's exactly what happens thousands of times in every part of the industry. In the defense industry, you'll see generals and admirals and procurement officers leaving there and going over to the very companies they were supposed to be monitoring and getting big, nice paychecks for it. It's utterly corrupt. So you don't have public-private, you have private-private. All right? There's no public because you and I are kept in the dark, just as you heard him say. They won't tell who's giving the money, how much, and for what. Well, why? If we're paying that person's salary and all their bonuses and commissions, why can't we know more about it? But we can't. And every single president, every single president's cabinet, every single one of the people working in the government support this system. And yet they don't support the American public, because ask yourself, show me one single community in the United States. I'm not saying a city, I'm saying a community that the government in its private public efforts, spending hundreds of millions of dollars, have gone and actually redid the community so the community now has work, has manufacturing, has a living wage, has standard living increase for all the people in that community. Again, I'm not even saying a city, I'm saying a community. You can't find one single community in the entire United States that the government has done anything for. And if you want an example of how you're really thought of, take a look at Palestine, Ohio. Our excuse for Secretary of Treasury goes, Yellen, goes over to Ukraine, gives him a $1 billion check this week. How much did we give the citizens of Palestine to relocate out of harm's way? How much? What, $1,000? How long does that last? What are they supposed to relocate to? It's a whole poor community. The whole area is poor. And they're told, drink the water, go back in there, plant a garden. Everything's safe. It's not. It never will be in those people's lifetimes. Because when that chemicals goes into the ground, it can go down with rain, probably to about 6 feet. You're going to take 6 feet of topsoil out of there? Good luck with that. So you see, almost everything anyone in government tells you is going to be distorted, biased, or a lie. Now, the question is not that these are people that you shouldn't trust. The question is, why do you trust them? What's going on in your mind that you still trust them, if you do? And there are those in our country now, the majority of Americans don't trust them. Good for them. Because as long as you keep saying no to them about everything that's important to you, you at least have taken a stand. I'm going to play a different clip. Let's now go to this clip. I want to support all of the parents out there and grandparents and people who've had children and know what it's like, all the effort, all the challenges, all the arguments, all the crying and screaming and yelling and door slamming at different times, especially with teenagers. I hate you, slams the door. I never want to see you, slams the door. I wish you were not my parents, slams the door. 20 minutes later, I need to go to the mall. Okay, so all those things you just said, weaponizing those words, and then they just go about their business. Every generation, including Cicero, we've had these contentious situations. But at least you know that the input you're giving as a parent will make a difference. You don't want your child learning something that will be deleterious to their mental well-being. And yet, the people within our educational system have virtually captured it. And these are ideologues. We see how dumbing down the educational system is today. And then we see all the sexualization of literature. They will ban something in an adult book and put 10 times worse language in a children's book. They want to legitimate pedophilia. Yeah, and they're succeeding in many ways. But here's one case where a young 11-year-old boy named Knox Zajac from Maine went to his local school board and read them material from a book that was being promoted in the school, featured in the school. He's 11 years old. And young boys and girls from 8, 9, 10 could read this. Here's what he has to say. It's short.
Hi, my name's Knox Zajac. I'm 11 years old, and I go to Windham Middle School. I'm a sixth grader. I was in the library, and this book was on a stand. I'd like to read you a page. My back over my hips as I ask if we should take our clothes off. And he's saying yes before I finish my sentence. He's pulling off my t-shirt, laughing when I can't undo his shirt buttons. He's undoing my belt. I'm reaching into his bedside drawer for a condom. We're kissing. Again, we're rolling over. Obviously, you can see where this is going. I don't know if it's because we're feeling especially emotional or just tired, or these past couple of weeks have been too much. But this reminds me so much of the first time we had sex. We were both terrified, and the whole thing was kind of terrible because we didn't know what we were doing. But it was good too, so good, because we were a mess of emotions, and we were scared and excited, and everything felt new. So this sort of thing, this sort of feels like that. Nick touches me like he's scared that any minute. Now, this book was at my middle school, and it was on a stand. When I rented it out to show my dad it, the librarian asked if I wanted more and if I wanted a graphic novel version.
Oh, boy. So I'm that kid's father.
Okay, good. I was asking for you.
Yeah, I'll take another 3 minutes. So that's my son.
Okay.
11 years old, and went to his library and found that by the entry door of our library, this is the smut that he is finding, all right? I don't care whether it's gay, straight, bisexual, whatever the terms are for all this stuff, doesn't need to be at our school. Doesn't need to be at my 11-year-old's library. And then as far as genderqueer, I've got a son in the high school as well. And this is we know it, all right? We do not need to be having literature that's showing boys, all right? This is I'm very, very frustrated about it, okay? And you may think that schools know the best for our children. You know who know the best for our children? The parents.
Being a teacher for 45 years, teaching thousands of students, I would never suggest that I as a teacher or any other teacher has the right to determine when a child should be exposed to sexual material and in what ways. That is the responsibility of the parents. Now, if parents can't do that and want to seek counseling, there are plenty of people who can help them if that is needed. But now the school doesn't want the parent having anything to do with it. It's just like when children were being told not to tell their parents they had been vaccinated. Could you imagine now realizing how many young boys in particular have myocarditis? So therefore, if they exercise, they'll have a heart attack. So if you have myocarditis, do not exercise. In fact, there's the case of a top athlete, 30-year-old top athlete, one of the best pro ball football players. He just retired because he found out he has myocarditis, and he didn't want to end up dead. And we're seeing all these dead athletes everywhere and other people dying with no obvious reason why, except they were vaccinated. The administrations are not taking responsibility. The industry is not taking responsibility. That private public propaganda campaign takes no responsibility. Think of it this way also. Bill Gates has got the power to influence every industry. Bill Gates invested somewhere around, I believe it was $5 million in a particular stock involving vaccination. He just sold it for $500 million. So he's out of it. Now he's saying, oh, well, no, they weren't that good. Well, that's not what he was saying. He's saying he went into the pandemic, have every single person on earth vaccinated. Really? And what gives you the right to tell people that the only way out is to vaccinate? Are you an epidemiologist? Are you internal medicine? Are you a nutritionist? Do you know anything about autoimmune conditions and what happens when you inject a toxic vaccine into a person that already has an autoimmune condition? You kill them. You make them more susceptible. And yet he is respected, and people who told the truth are attacked. That should tell you everything you need to know about the world we're living in today. I'm interested in your feedback. Give us a call. Please do so. Happy to hear what you have to say on these issues. And I'm seeing that we have, oh, by the way, I just want to mention, I have tomorrow's show is going to be an anti-aging. I'm going to share with you the results of our study, which I haven't been able to share up to this point, but I'm having a 3 o'clock meeting today with a person from the university who headed the anti-aging division on the genetic consequence of the protocols used, and it's really historic. I mean, it literally is historic. I'm going to talk about that tomorrow. Plus, I'm going to give you probably the most in-depth discussion you've ever heard about your immune system. That's tomorrow. Today, I want to mention that we're going to be doing a health retreat. Now, do not confuse this with anti-aging. This is not about anti-aging. This is about helping people detoxify, relax, learn way more than what they would learn anywhere else about how to regain their health, mental and physical and spiritual, how to repurpose their life no matter what their age, how to overcome obstacles no matter how challenging they may be, and how to smile each day because you've re-embraced happiness and joy and unconditional love. It's one of the most beautiful places in America. A phenomenal staff that comes from all over the country. Classes all day long on meditation and yoga and Qigong and Tai Chi and power walking and exercising in the gym and water aerobics and artist healing. We have so many talented staff. And it's a pleasure to work with them. And we also have an outstanding chef giving gourmet meals, vegan, gluten-free recipes. So it's going to be and juicing throughout the day and lots of quiet time with nature. You can't beat that. All of us need that. I need that. That's why I live down here in Florida in an animal sanctuary and because each day I have a chance to run in the fields with my dogs. I have a chance to, you know, be around the birds and the swans and in nature without pollution, without noise. Just sitting watching a sunset over the Gulf, it's so beautiful. And yet I'm back enough far from the Gulf that the storms don't tear my place apart. So we need time for ourselves. We rarely give it to ourselves. We need to be responsible for our own needs. We're almost always over-responsible for other people's needs. We need a chance just to exhale and inhale new vital life force. I'm going to be doing lots of workshops on energy. And I'm going to probably do around 10 to 15 lectures a week. You can come for 1 or 2 weeks until it's filled. And it's going to fill almost instantly. And I understand we have someone who was at our retreat. Her name is Michelle Foster. And let's just see what Michelle has to say she learned and she experienced. Hi, Michelle. Nice to have you on.
Hi, Gary. Can you hear me?
I sure can. Please tell your story to the audience.
Briefly, yeah, I have gone to several of the retreats. The first retreat I went to, the first week went so well that I decided to stay a second week. There's a lot of good healing that goes on at these retreats. What's amazing to me is that you start with the lectures and the food. The chef is amazing. The workshops are absolutely phenomenal. And then also, everything is just ran so well. Things were ran so well that I became a staff member. And I love to see people having a good time, and I love to see the changes of people as they transform throughout the week.
What changes did you experience?
Quite a few changes since the last time you saw me, Gary. Since the last time you saw me, I have lost an additional 25 pounds. My A1C has gone down 2 whole points, and my blood sugars in general are running probably about 70 points lower than they were the last time I saw you.
Is it true that in 1 week being there, your blood sugar from no medicines went from a high level to losing almost 100 points thereabouts to where it was normal?
Yes, that actually happened, yeah, within 1 week of being at your retreat.
Yeah, no medicines. That's just the normal activity. And yet you never told me your blood sugar. It's the protocols that we implement there that are health protocols. Did you see other changes in other people, just normal people changing their health in that 1 week?
The one thing that was the most phenomenal to me was that the gentleman that could not eat, he had had a lot of trouble digesting food. And like you said, within a couple of days, he was eating all the food that we have there at the retreat, you know, 3 meals a day, 2 meals a day, and juicing and everything. And he was, at the end of the first week, he was asking other people if they were going to finish their meals. The other one that was phenomenal was the gentleman that had full-blown Alzheimer's. His Alzheimer's was so advanced that he was just kind of like staring in space. And then probably at the end of the second week, he was cracking jokes and recognizing people and just, you know, engaging with everybody.
Were you there the day that last full day where everyone was asked to go for a walk, whatever you can do? And we had golf carts out on the course. We had Dr. Steve there and the nurses, Barbara Duncan and all the others, and Luann. And we had Elaine there in case they needed their legs rubbed out. And there was a young woman there, I think she was 23, and she couldn't walk from her apartment to the subway a half a block. She would have to then rest for hours. Were you there when she walked the marathon?
Yes, I was there when she walked the marathon. And, I didn't complete the marathon, but I did 21 miles. And I had not walked a marathon before then or even 20 miles before then. But, yes, I remember the young lady that had, MS, I believe. But, yeah, she walked the entire marathon.
And yet when she got there, she couldn't walk one foot in front of the other. She'd fall over or hold herself in the air with one foot. She'd fall over, and yet she did a marathon. And also doing that marathon, well, no, he stopped because he said he was hungry, was the gentleman who hadn't been able to eat normal food, had to use it liquefied or through a tube for 20 years. And he did, I think, 12 miles and said, I'm hungry. And he stopped to get lunch. Do you remember the gentleman who I literally went out in the road and grabbed him by the shoulder, says, enough, buddy. He's no, I got more to do. I said, you've done 30 miles. He wanted to do 40 miles. Remember that?
Yeah, I do remember him. And I remember he had stage 4 COPD and another.
Stage 4 leukemia.
Stage 4 leukemia. Oh, okay.
No.
And I remember they told him. Oh, okay. Yes.
He had two terminal illnesses.
Right. And they told him to get his affairs in order, basically. And he decided to come to the retreat. And as you said, at the end of the second week, he had walked 30 miles of ultra marathon, I believe.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Never having done in this at a very fast pace, but also when he went home, his pulmonologist could not find any blockage. So he went to another group of pulmonologists and then a third group of pulmonologists. And there was no blockage, has no COPD. Then his oncologist, I got his medical records, and because we're doing an article on him, someone wants to, I'm not doing it, but someone who will remain unnamed at this moment, someone very famous in the anti-aging field, is writing an article on five of the people, and because now they want to see the medical records, which we got them before and after of all the people who had these remarkable changes. And when he went, his white blood cell count, I believe, was 261,000. Today, it's 9,000. That's completely normal, up to 11,000 normal. His oncologist said, I don't know what you've done, but it's there's no drug that could do this. So he's living a normal, healthy life. We look forward to him being back in May. These are real things. Has anything I just said been exaggerated?
Oh, no, nothing. And there was one more young lady who was in her mid-30s who had the stage 4 breast cancer. And she was basically told to get her affairs in order. And she came to the retreat, and I think she's been cancer-free for, 5 years now?
Yes.
Or something like that?
She's cancer-free. She'll also be there. So these are the things that people have a hard time thinking can happen, since at no time do I treat anyone. I don't diagnose and treat, but the energy and the environment and the positive insights to liberate your healing energy. And that's why I said this time I'm going to focus upon liberating people's innate energy in a beautiful, tranquil environment, a butterfly house, a meditation room that is from the 18th century French gazebo. Everything that a person needs to start their journey of wellness is there. It's just their responsibility to say, it's time for me to look after myself, since I've looked after everyone else, and to do so. Thank you very much, Michelle.
And thank you for everything, Gary.
And that's Michelle Foster, and you'll meet her there. If you come, you'll meet some remarkable people there. So if you want to join us, because we'll probably be full very shortly, because I like to keep the groups relatively small. You'll give Luann a call, because Luann screens everyone to see if this is right for you. If you're negative and toxic, angry and bitter, accusatory, this is not for you. If you're a person that's looking at how to change the negative in your life to a positive, this is for you. Call Luann at 903-881-7008. 903-881-7008. Time now for a person who's making major changes in her life, but she'll tell you what those are. Eutrice Lead. Have a nice day, everyone.